People who have travelled across the North American prairies speak of it being a rather dull, boring, monotonous experience. One such traveller said, "I recall once travelling by train from Montreal to Vancouver, straight across Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and Alberta. Hour after hour, day after day, the train thundered westward, and all there was to see was the open plain. To me, it was the most uninteresting scenery on earth." Having visited some parts of America, I know what he's saying. His journey was across the Canadian plains. I've been across some of the very agricultural landscape in America, and it just stretches flat for miles as far as the eye can see. Now, what a contrast if you go, for example, just across our little waterway here into Scotland, or somewhat further into Europe and into the Alps around France, and maybe even in particular to Switzerland, and find there a country that is full of mountains and valleys, constantly changing in the different points of view and the vantage points and the field of perspective. One time you're coming along and there's a field of purple bloom, then you've got a flock of mountain sheep out there, some little Scottish village with its terrace cottage clinging to the side of some hill. You've got mist swirling around, even a storm that is breaking or brewing on a green yet craggy mountainside. People who are prairie-born and prairie-bred can doubtless see, as they look across the plains, some beauty there. But I would imagine that most people would say, "Give me the mountains and the valleys every single time." They may be more dangerous to cross, but they are never dull, never monotonous. In Psalm 27, we are in the mountains, although for a time we dip down into the valley too, because the psalm that we have here today clearly divides into two parts. The first half we see David, and he's trusting here on the highlands of faith. That's verse 1 through to the verse 6. But in the second half of the psalm, beginning in verse 7 through to 12, I suppose we could say, but maybe right to 14, we have him trembling down in the lowlands of fear. Up on the mountain, then down in the valley. But in fairness, by verse 13 and 14, he's beginning to climb up off the valley floor again, and he sees the mountain peak once more, and he's looking to get right up there onto the peak again. So great is the contrast between these two main sections of the psalm that some commentators have come along to the psalm, looked at it, tried to divide it up, analyze it, and they've said, you know, this is not the work of one man. Two men must have been involved here, because they argue that not one single man could go so suddenly from faith to fear, from trust to trembling, from confidence to cowardice. There must be two individuals writing here from completely different perspectives. Up, then down. Followers of the field forecaster, Mr. Harold Camping, have known a very up and down experience in recent days and weeks. Their leader, you'll know, predicted that the true people of God in the world would be raptured on Saturday week ago, and his adherents, Campingites, I suppose we could call them, because really what you've got there is the same kind of path followed by the Jehovah's Witnesses, under Charles Taze Russell, the Millerites, and out of that movement came the Seventh-day Adventists as well. They're all date-setters and big predictors, and they're from the same stable. Saturday week ago, the people of God in the world should have been raptured, and they thought and really believe we are going up. Some of those people sold their homes and sold their businesses in expectation of the end. Others just walked out of their jobs. One man packed his entire family up, drove cross-country to be at the gate of Camping's compound in California so that he would be there ready for the hour of destiny. It's claimed that a woman killed her daughter and then herself because she couldn't bear facing this end of things. But Saturday, 21st of May, 2011 came, and Saturday, 21st of May, 2011, all around the world, in its different time zones, it went as well, and those followers were still here. But now, instead of being carried up, they're very much down. I do feel really sorry for them. Those all too believing members of his church family, Radio International, who have donated over the years millions of dollars to this organization to help propagate the message about the end of the world, believing all the time they are one of the chosen who will be taken up to heaven when the hour comes. Harold Camping is looking pretty red-faced. After Saturday week ago's eventual failure, he hid in a motel with his family, apparently. Such was his fear and embarrassment that his prediction had again proven to be incorrect, and I say again advisedly. He is history in this one. Back on the 21st of May, 1988, he predicted a date of doom. On the 7th of September, 1994, going back further again, it was going to be a date of doom where the world would meet its destiny and the people of God would be raptured. Those dates came and those dates went, though this hasn't stopped him, even the latest failure, from pointing his followers again to yet another high point, 21st of October 2011. Surely, after predicting and failing, there comes a time in your analysis of affairs that you just have to give up and admit it's all folly. Or what the Bible says, no man knoweth that day or that hour wherein the Son of Man cometh. So for them it's been up and down, up and down. But to log into the psalmist experience here in Psalm 27 and find him in the mountain, then down in the valley, we only really have to look at our own deceitful hearts to see that such a change is not only possible, but it happens all the time. And sometimes this experience takes place, this change, within the one prayer. I'm serious when I say that fear and faith often fight each other for the mastery of our soul and of our mind. So I'm more than content to leave the authorship from the start of the psalm right to the end of the psalm in the lap of one man from the pen of one author, David, all the way. He was up, then down, and so if we're honest are we. So we find him first here, trusting on the highlands of faith. Verse 1 through 6, the psalm opens with a joyful note. David is voicing his confidence in God, and two aspects of that faith of his readily appear. He is delight in the Lord, verse 1 to 3. That confidence that David has in God is not a passing whim. It's not some religious fad that came upon him one day and left the next day. That faith that he has in God was based and anchored in three things. One was, in verse 1, we find that the Lord's personal dealings with him. The Lord, he says, is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? Martin Luther used to say it all revolves around the personal pronouns, our relationship with God. And you can see the personal aspect here. God's personal dealings with David. How does he put it? Verse 1, the Lord is my light and my salvation. The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? And over the years, David had put the Lord to the test in many a trying circumstance, and God had never come up wanting. Picture the prodigal son, New Testament times, and the prodigal's out with a swill bucket in the farmer's lonely field in a country, and he's far from home, and he begins to think there, and my father's servants, you know, they're dressed far better than I am out here. Look at the state of me, they're better housed, better paid, better treated than I am in this foreign land. I'm going home. I'm just going to say to my father, Father, I've sinned, shouldn't have done what I did. Terribly ridiculous and sinful thing to do. Please just give me a job on the farm again. I don't expect to be your son any longer. I don't expect privileges like I had before. Just put me on the payroll as one of your hired hands. The prodigal, you see, was dredging up from his memory long forgotten thoughts of his father. How good it had been. How wonderful that relationship was. Experience told him that his father would treat him, at least with the level of generosity and goodness and gentleness that he showed to his hired servants. And so that prodigal comes home, depending on some personal dealings with the father. David, in his hour of trial, bases everything upon his personal knowledge of God, who God was to him, my light, my salvation, the strength of my life. But his faith is not only based upon the Lord's personal dealings, but the Lord's past dealings. Verse 2, you'll see that. When the wicked, even mine enemies and my foes, came upon me to eat up my flesh, they stumbled and fell. All past tense. What had happened in former days is what's in focus in verse 2. His enemies, despite all of their ferocity, despite every force that they could assemble, had never been able to get that close to David that they could do him harm. Time after time, God had stepped in and God had delivered him. I suggest we can see the same thing in our own personal history. Had we kept a diary, and maybe you have done, but had we kept a diary through the years of all of our spiritual experiences within life, I'm certain of this, the pages of those diaries would record countless examples of God's unfailing goodness and grace. Yeah, we'd strayed. Yes, we had failed the Lord. Yes, we had fallen down into sin, into shame, but we can recount stories of the Lord's dealings with us, like David, when the wicked, even mine enemies and my foes, came upon me to eat up my flesh. They stumbled and fell. They thought I had fallen, and I had. They weren't holding back from kicking a man when he was down. They were determined now that I was at a low ebb. They would take me out completely, but they found they couldn't do it. And so on the basis of God's past dealings with him, David stands here on the highlands of faith, trusting in God because of God's personal dealing, because of his past dealing, and we too can say, hitherto, right up until this point, hath the Lord helped us. We can do as Samuel did, raise the memorial stone between Mizpah and Shen, call it Ebenezer, and cry over it, hitherto hath the Lord helped us. Those enemies, those foes that came upon us, trying to eat up our flesh, they were the ones who recoiled in defeat. They stumbled and they fell because the angel of the Lord, posted by God around our lives, stood guard time and time again. The third anchorage or basis that David built his faith here upon was the Lord's promised dealings. Verse 3. Though an host should encamp against me. You know, if this should happen in the future, my heart shall not fear. Though war should rise against me, in this will I be confident. David knew here that he was on the victory side. Samuel had anointed him king over Israel. Though Saul was opposing him now, the holy oil had been poured upon David's head in secret because God had promised him the throne. So not all of Saul's forces, not all the combined army that Saul could call on, not any amount of hostility could stop David from sitting on the throne that God had appointed for him. And so as he looked into the future, he was saying, you know something? Though the host should encamp against me, though war should rise against me, I will not fear. I will be confident. The future is in good hands. It's in the plan and the purpose of God. And I'm content, David is saying here, to leave it there. So the Lord's promised dealings, past dealings, personal dealings with David, caused him to delight in the Lord and cry, "He's my light. He's my salvation." Notice as well, though, his desire for the Lord that's expressed here, verse 4 through to the verse 6, his desire for the Lord. His heart, I guess we could say, had a twin desire, branched out into two desires. He wanted the presence of the Lord in his house. Verse 4, one thing have I desired of the Lord. That will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. Daily, this was the passion of his heart. God to be in his temple and David to be present there worshipping him. Not just on the Sabbath. He didn't attend the services in the tabernacle or temple out of a sense of duty. He wanted to be in and around the place in the spirit and attitude of worship all the time. This was where his heart was. This was where his treasure was. And he wanted to be there all the days of my life. Psalm 23 sees him expand on this when he says, I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Not only all the days of my earthly pilgrimage, but forever, through all eternity, in the house of the Lord, beholding the beauty of the Lord. Now, if we are going to dwell in the house of the Lord forever, it follows that we'd want to dwell there all the days of our life, to be in communion with God, in other words, all the days of our earthly pilgrimage. Howard Camping, to bring him in again, because he's been so much in the news recently, decided, back around 1988, God stopped working through the churches, so he got out. Well, he fell out with his local church, and so he withdrew. Started these home meetings. Denigrated every church that he knew about. Said all those pastors, you know, since 1988, they're just the agents and ministers of the devil. Come to me. Have your house meetings. This is the way forward for the real, true church of God upon the earth. David would have said, you've got it wrong, Harold. You've entirely misread Scripture. You're acting in disobedience to the God of heaven. David's desire is here that he would dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of his life, to behold the beauty of the Lord, to inquire in his temple. That was what was throbbing within his heart. He had a love for the meeting place where God's people assembled. He had a passion to be there. And if we don't, then there's something radically wrong with us. In the New Testament, the book of Hebrews 10:25, we're implored not to forsake the assembling of yourselves together, as the manner of some is, and so much the more as ye see the day approaching. What day? The day of Jesus' return. So in other words, the closer we get to the day of Jesus' return, the more we should have a heart for assembling with the people of God, worshipping him in anticipation of that glorious event. Camping says, no, the Bible's wrong there. Do that in reverse. The closer we get to the day of the Lord's coming again, stay away from church. Boycott the church. Don't assemble with the people there that are in the churches. Just tune in to Family Radio International and come along to my compound and all of that. David here has a deliberate passion and a daily passion, a discerning passion to behold the beauty of the Lord, to inquire in his temple. Just a view of God's beauty in Christ. will so enrapture and infatuate our hearts that we will want to share in the joy of the Lord's presence in his house. So the presence of the Lord in his house, that's one part of his desire. The other part, the protection of the Lord in his house. Verse 5 and verse 6. For in the time of trouble, he will hide me in his pavilion. In the secret of his tabernacle shall he hide me. He shall set me up upon a rock, and now shall mine head be lifted up above mine enemies round about me. Therefore will I offer in his tabernacle sacrifices of joy. I will sing, yea, I will sing praises unto the Lord. Back in medieval times, it would have been a practice for a person who was under the active displeasure of a lord or a king or a baron or one of the earls to flee into the nearest church and plead sanctuary and refuge. That custom, of course, has its roots in the Old Testament. Whenever they come into the land of promise, the land of Canaan, they appointed 3 cities in one part of the land, 3 cities in another part of the land, 6 in total, as cities of refuge, that if the man slew someone else by accident, he could run to that city of refuge and find that he would be protected within the city of refuge. But none of these could shelter David from Saul. So he's looking for sanctuary in the house of God, not a physical four-walled building. That was impossible now, but spiritually, in the presence of God, even out there in the wilderness, Lord, hide me in thy pavilion. In the secret of your tabernacle, hide me, set me up upon a rock, defend me from mine enemies. So that prayer goes out of verse 5, hide me. The great English Calvinist, Augustus Toplady, when he was seeking refuge from a physical and a very violent storm on one occasion, got into the cleft of a rock, took refuge there. And out of that experience, one of the greatest hymns that we sing was born, Rock of Ages, cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee. And David here in the verse 5 of the psalm is pleading, Lord, hide me, let me hide myself in thee. And in verse 6, another cry, Lord, help me. And now shall mine head be lifted up above mine enemies round about me. Therefore will I offer in his tabernacle sacrifices of joy. I will sing. Yea, I will sing praises unto the Lord. This, verse 6, is the high point of the psalm, where David sees all of his enemies routed, and he's bringing in the sacrifices of celebration, of triumph, into the sanctuary, praising God. So here he's climbing higher and higher up the mountain, standing on its glorious summit. And from that summit, he looks around and sees around him the vista of victory. He sees future moments where there would be total and complete triumph that would belong to him. And so he lifts up his soul in song. I will sing, yea, I will sing praises unto Jehovah. Haven't there been times in our lives when God has impregnated within our heart this song? Deliverance, Lord, we are praising you, for you've helped us, you've hidden us, you've given us victory in this trying circumstance, right on the top of the mountain. But suddenly, David falls. And from the mountaintop, he tumbles down those steep slopes until he ends up far below in the deep, dark valley of doubt. Now, we said at the beginning, this transition from mountaintop to valley floor is so startling, and it's so sudden, that some have come in here and tried to argue for another author taking over him and writing the remainder of this 27th psalm. But it's not so, because most of us have tumbled down this steep slope ourselves, and just as quickly, trusting on the highlands of faith. He is now, in verse 7, trembling on the lowlands of fear. Trembling on the lowlands of fear. We must never lose sight of the fact that fear lives right next door to faith. Those who have an issue, problem, difficulty, trying circumstance in their lives hardly need to be reminded of this. We ride the roller coaster from fear to faith, fear to faith, over and over again. One moment we say, everything's going to work out fine. But the next moment we're looking at our circumstances from a totally different perspective and an absolute despair of mind and heart. And we think, it's not going to turn out. I felt that. My family felt that last week. Things were going well. Operation seemed to be a success. Then the heart attack came and back down again. Up and down, up and down. One of the doctors said, you know, whenever anybody's in ICU, it's a roller coaster. And you know, that's the way it is. And David here, having been up on that mountain, is now tumbled right down onto the valley. And he recognizes the need that he has when he gets there for a fresh experience of grace. He wants the grace of God. Verse 7 through to the verse 10, underline that. He is desolate, he is even despondent. That's how he feels. Verse 7, hear, O Lord, when I cry with my voice, have mercy also upon me and answer me. When thou said, seek ye my face, my heart said unto thee, thy face, Lord, will I seek. Can you hear me, Lord? I'm not sure you can. Can you hear my cry? Do you understand my circumstances? I know I shouldn't be down here in the dumps, in the valley. But Lord, it's important to me because I'm not sure about this. Can you hear me? That's what he's saying. There's nothing more desolate than the feeling of those who are rejected, they think, by the people they love or the people they admire. One of our strongest psychological, emotional, spiritual needs in life is to be accepted. We crave, all of us, whether we admit it or not is another thing, we crave acceptance. And it's astonishing to what lengths we'll go to get it. That's why it's so difficult for celebrities. They're built up onto a pedestal. Everybody's fawning over them. Everybody wants to be like them. They all want to be in their shoes. But as soon as they pump them up there, they come along with all of the heavy machinery tools and try to make that pedestal crumble right at its base and pull down the very people that they have exalted. The feeling of rejection is a dreadful one that the devil always exploits to the full. Ask Cheryl Cole in the past week with her rather inglorious exit from the American X Factor. Up, straight down. And David, having come this way in his physical and spiritual experience, he looks for the grace of God. He appeals here to his Father in heaven. Psalm 27, verse 9. Hide not thy face far from me. Put not thy servant away in anger. Thou hast been my help. Leave me not, neither forsake me, O God of my salvation. Of course, God never leaves us, never forsakes his child, but sometimes it feels like he has. David had that feeling. Rejected by his father, also by his family on earth. There was a problem here. Verse 10 makes it clear. When my father and my mother forsake me, then the Lord will take me up. We don't know what prompted this statement. But we know there was a time when David was in the cave of Adullam, and he was taking refuge from Saul in that cave, that Saul, on the outside, became so frenzied and so indiscriminate that David felt, for my own parents' safety, I'll have to remove them from off the farm and bring them to the relative safety of the cave here. And even that cavernous cave of Adullam David began to lose a bit of confidence in that his parents would really be safe with him staying there. So he approached the king of Moab and he requested that his parents be allowed political asylum down in the land of Moab. After all, Jesse's own grandmother was Ruth. She was a woman of Moab. So there was one sense in which part of the family would be going back to a kind of an ancestral home. We never hear of David's mother or father again, that they ever came back from the land of Moab, so maybe they died there. Maybe David had just heard of their death in the land of Moab. Or maybe they were saying, David, we think you have adopted a reckless course here. All we know, he had a feeling of being forsaken even by his family. Even when my father and my mother forsake me, then the Lord will take me up. And of course, that's what God delights to do. He loves to be the good Samaritan. He will pick us up. When we're down, forsaken by everyone, he will gather us into his arms. So he pleads here for the grace of God, for the guidance of God as well. Verse 11 and verse 12, teach me thy way, O Lord, and lead me in a plain path because of mine enemies. A plain path, a level or an even path. The word enemies is a word that means watchful foes. They were looking out for him. They were preparing an ambush against him. They were lying in wait to catch him unawares. David isn't praying for an easy path. He's simply saying, Lord, direct my steps. Get me through this minefield. Direction, guidance. Teach me thy way, lead me in a plain path, deliverance. Verse 12, deliver me not over unto the will of mine enemies, for false witnesses are risen up against me, and such as breathe out cruelty. When the devil can't take us down by weaponry, he will do it by words. And David feared the tongues of his enemies as much as he feared the swords of those foes. So he's saying, Lord, I need your grace. I need your guidance as well. And also, finally, the goodness of God he appeals to in verse 13 and 14. We said earlier, now he's beginning to crawl up the mountainside once more. From the mountaintop down into the valley, now he's on the way back out of the valley, up from the lowlands of fear towards the mountains of faith. Verse 13, I had fainted. There's another turning point. Unless I had believed to see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. The hymn book has come out of his pocket again. And he's beginning to flick to the words, how good is the God we adore, our faithful, unchangeable friend. The goodness of God he glimpses again. And in verse 14, wait on the Lord, be of good courage, and he shall strengthen thine heart. Wait, I say, on the Lord. It's not going to be a quick process, he reminds himself. He's bringing not only the trust element back in verse 13, I had believed to see, but the time element in verse 14, wait on the Lord. Wait, I say, on the Lord. Be of good courage as you wait. God will strengthen your heart. What he has promised, he will undoubtedly perform. He's never in a hurry. He can never fail. The great thing is to be patient and wait. I know in my experience, you know in yours, that's the hardest thing, to wait. Instant. That appeals. Immediate, we want that. Straight results, straight away. That's what we're in for. It's not how God works oftentimes. Wait on the Lord. Wait, I say, on the Lord. That was the thing that King Saul, scurrying about, trying to take out David, couldn't do. There was nothing about waiting in his life. He was all in a frenzy. And that failure and frenzy was to cost Saul his crown. David, from being on the mountaintop, then down in the valley, then beginning to get up to the mountaintop again, he had learned a lifelong lesson from watching Saul and from seeing God work in his life. And so his parting word to us here in Psalm 27, in the middle of our need, is wait. Don't wait fretfully. Don't wait fitfully. Don't wait fatalistically. Wait on the Lord. And you'll come up from that valley of doubt and the lowland of fear onto the mountaintop of faith again.